one body bag or two?
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome. It is Tea Time Horror Stories, or Tea Time Horrors. Tea Time Horrors, whatever tickles your fancy. It is Sam as your host, and then you have your co-host,
Joe.
And we're here for another episode of True Crime.
Today's True Crime. I hope you're ready, because I am not.
He's like half asleep. Soon that will change, because I have a bunch of drinks in front of us. And one of those so happened to be Vietnamese coffee. And a Vietnamese coffee, I hope, will wake you up. But also, I have a surprise for you.
What?
I have a surprise for you. Okay, give me a minute.
What did you do? The anticipation, the excitement. Woo. Ta-da! You got donuts.
I brought food, sustenance. Nice. Can you guess what's in there?
Is there a maple bar?
You can open it and find out.
Yes, that's a yes.
Open it and find out. Who knows? They could have been out of maple bars for the day. Just rip it open. My life, people. My life. You are... Joe, should I get you a knife? Don't move it around so much.
Eclairs. And a maple bar.
Yep, I got you a maple bar, got some eclairs, and I got my vanilla cupcake.
Sugar before my dinner. Yay.
Yes, because afterwards we're going to have food, and we're going to have like a mini Korean barbecue thing going. We're going to have brisket and pork belly. But that's later. That's something we can look forward to after the podcast.
After.
All right. Ow. So, all right. Let's see. What has happened?
You took off your shoes. You got donuts. I came back home from work. Is that what you were looking for? I don't know.
You're not really talking into your mic, by the way.
All of those things I just said. I know it was kind of hard for you to hear, but I said things.
All right. So, yeah. Since last time, not much has changed. I'm actually going to be going back to work. For those of you that didn't know, I'm currently
talking about current events, not what happened.
Yes. So I was on disability because I was sick, and now I am 90% better, enough for me to got clearance to go back to work from my doctor, but just part-time. But I'm kind of excited to go back to work, because that income would be very helpful.
Much appreciated.
Much helpful, especially since I got a new car. So we got to make sure we got to make those payments on time, and we need to save up, because we're saving up for a house too. So yeah, just a lot of shit. I haven't heard back from the dispatching place, which is not necessarily bad. It's just anxiety ridden like crazy, because I keep thinking, why haven't they emailed me? Why haven't they asked me anything? Why? Just a bunch of whys. That's just who I am. That's just how I am. But they told me specifically during my second interview that the background process takes 3 to 6 weeks. I'm barely on like 2.5 weeks right now, but we're going to find out how that goes. Otherwise, yeah, no, that's it. I know our lives are boring. I'm just working on school and psychology. Why is psychology so annoying? But
you're still passing it with flying colors, and that's what matters. That's what matters.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't talking into the mic again. I apologize.
I'm trying. I'm trying. I'm doing what I can. But other than that, cats. All my cats are sleeping next to me.
Yes.
But I got us drinks. So while Joe was driving back from work, I went to one of the cafes. We've actually been to this cafe before.
This is the second time
we've been there, because we really like their drink. We like their house special drink that they had there, which was really fucking good. And I was so tempted to get that. But instead, I decided to venture out and try two new things. So
get the espresso?
Yes, I did get the espresso. I also got the coconut one. Let's tell them where it's from. Sorry.
Surprising that you got coconut.
We went to this place. We've been to before. It's La Cafe.
La Cafe.
So it's like LACAPHE with accents on them. So La Cafe, however you want to pronounce it. And I decided to get three new drinks that I wanted to try that I hope that I would like. But like Joe mentioned, One of them is coconut.
Coconut. She don't like coconut, which is a surprise that she decided to go with that option.
Well, the reason why is because I semi like coconut. I just don't like the coconut flakes. I don't like the texture of coconut.
You do realize that it's got like blended,
yes,
toasted coconut flakes.
I am aware. That's why I wanted to take a small sip, and I figured I could just pawn it off to you if I don't like it. But I wanted to try it because I do like pina coladas. I like drinking the is it the milk? The milk of the coconut?
Coconut milk, yeah.
Yeah, I like drinking that sometimes, but I just don't like the texture. The texture is what bothers me. I don't know if I'm usually not a picky person.
It's a textural thing for a lot of people because it's got like this kind of crunchy flavor to it, or crunchy texture, but it's not crunchy. It's kind of chewy, but not chewy.
I don't know what it is.
It's a weird
but
texture.
What I hate specifically the most is coconut flakes.
Mm-hmm.
Like the coconut flakes just drive me crazy. I don't know what it is. They just fucking do. But that being said, I got a coconut drink. I got a something that was called an egg espresso. So they put egg cream on top of it. And then I decided to get something that wasn't coffee, which is a strawberry tea.
Yeah.
And I already took a drink of the strawberry tea. I approve. Love it. So refreshing. So good. Joe, why don't you take a drink of the strawberry? You might think it's too sugary, though.
It depends.
We might want to mix it.
Yeah, that is a lot of sugar.
I forgot to tell them to adjust the sugar in it, so I'm pretty sure they just gave us, like, regular. No? Is that a no for you?
Yeah, even watered down. I can tell they use the freeze-dried strawberries that you get, you know, like the Special K.
I kind of like those, though.
I do, but when it's not so much, like when it's like absorbed some of the milk in the cereal for the Special K, it has this nice flavor.
Happiness you can taste. That's what it says on the cup.
A penis you can taste?
Happiness.
It's from a movie.
Oh, the strawberry stuck in the straw. Okay, so that is not, Joe doesn't really like that one. So let's go on.
I didn't say it didn't like it. If it wasn't as sweet, it'd probably be.
Let's try the coconut.
Better.
Okay. Oh God. It's called Cocoa Freeze. Oh, it smells like coconut.
Was it supposed to be blended or is that a different drink?
I can taste the tasted coconut, like toasted coconut. I just you can have it.
It's honestly kind of tastes a little bit like the Bones coffee that you got me. Coconut. It actually tastes like that, but
you can have it.
No, I like it. This is
my egg espresso, and then this is your Vietnamese coffee with egg cream.
Egg cream.
I actually looked online how to make egg cream, and it's super easy.
Yeah, you literally just whipped the egg. You just whip the egg, basically.
No, you add.
Yeah, you. It's kind of like making a meringue. You add sugar and you whip. That's not how you make it.
It's just two egg yolks. Uh-huh. God damn it, Henry! Can you stop over there? Two egg yolks with sweetened condensed milk.
That's almost how you make meringue. It's just instead of adding a dry ingredient, you're adding another wet ingredient.
I don't know. I wish that the egg cream on it was a little bit
thicker.
Sweeter, kind of like the one from Disneyland.
It's subtle. It's still good though. I kind of like it.
Want to try mine? I don't know if I'm gonna like yours. Oh, there's more coffee in yours.
Okay.
Mine is basically the same thing as yours, except has less shots.
Yeah. Well, I figured what it almost kind of seems like is they mix the drinks up because they're so similar. Instead of using coffee, they just use the shots of espresso.
I like it. But I just wish that the cream was more like the one we got from Disneyland. I don't know, that one from Disneyland, so far has not. Nothing has beat that one from Disneyland.
Talking about the ube one, right? Or the egg cream.
The egg cream one that they have there.
That's by San Francisco.
San Francisco, yes. From Joffrey's, I think it's called
Joffrey's Coffee or
something like that, yeah. So we've already discussed what we're drinking. You guys did some ASMR listening to us. Alrighty, so what am I going to cover today?
You're covering the Coopster.
I'm covering true crime, and I call it true crime now, not just murder, because it's not necessarily murder anymore. I cover anything that is true crime, so it can be anything from murder to kidnapping to robbery, and that's exactly what this one is. This one is the hijacking of a plane by D.B. Cooper.
The Coopster.
The Coopster. All right. So This one is actually kind of long. We'll see how it goes. So let me get started. All right. Picture this. It's November 24th, 1971, and you're a flight attendant and you're doing your job. You are a crew of six consisting of Captain William A. Scott, First Officer William Bill J. Sorry, I'm going to butcher you guys' name. Ratikish, Flight Engineer Harold E. Anderson, and Flight Attendants Alice Hancock, Tina Merklow, and Francis Schaffner. There are 36 passengers on Flight 305 leaving Portland, Oregon on schedule at 2:50 p.m. heading towards Seattle, Washington.
Did you say the date?
Yes, November 24th, 1971.
I don't know why I missed that.
Yeah. You're doing your business, and shortly after takeoff, a man hands you a note. You don't think anything of it, as people have done this before. He's just another lonely businessman, probably giving his phone number to you. This has happened before. So you leave it unopened in your purse. When he notices that you don't open it or read the note, he leans toward you and whispers, "Miss, you better look at that note. I have a bomb." What do you do? How would you react?
Are you talking to me personally, or what? How do I think the lady reacted?
If you were the stewardess.
I'd be like, motherfucker, get back in your seat. Because I'm just like, okay, what drugs are you on? It's not okay. Get out of here.
Rule for initiatives.
Oh, jeez.
Just kidding. Sorry.
I was about to say.
No, but seriously.
So, thinking seriously, I'd be like, sir, get back to your seat. I don't have time for games. And then my next thing after that would be going to the air marshal.
I mean, is there an air marshal?
Well, you would assume that there's an air marshal on board.
There is not. I would have mentioned if there is an air marshal, but there isn't
you,
one.
You just mentioned you remember, names.
Back in the day, in 1971, hijackings weren't exactly the biggest thing.
Especially so when air marshals you're 10,000 feet in the, or 10,000 feet in the air. How
I don't know.
Any like
when you're high into the mm-hmm. into the sky, back in the day there weren't always air marshals. In fact, back in the day there was hardly any security when it came to planes. People literally just put their names and walked on with whatever they had on them. And at the time they were like hijackings. Why would there be hijackings? People used to be able to walk on with liquid, with guns, with weapons, with things that you could hurt someone with. And that was back in the days. And then honestly,
because there was an honor system back then. We're really high in the air. Why are you going to cause problems?
The only real reason everything got really, I mean, I'll get more into this later, but a lot of hijacking started happening after this, and even then, security didn't get jacked up until 9/11. 9/11 happened, and then that's when security now doesn't, like, security just got really, really hardcore. So, again, I'll cover that a little bit later, but let's get into it, okay? We are talking about a still unidentified man to this day that hijacked Northwest Orient Airline Flight 305, a Boeing 727 aircraft. We are talking about D.B. Cooper. D.B. Cooper is the hijacker and told a flight attendant he was armed with a bomb, demanded $200,000 in ransom. Okay, you want to guess the equivalent to that of how much that would cost nowadays?
How much was the...
$200,000.
70s with inflation, all the other good stuff. I'd say it's about 3 mil.
No, 1.2. Oh, I'm sorry, 1.5 mil in okay. today's time.
So I doubled it.
Well, you were a little bit closer than I thought you would be, but yeah, equivalently, that's 1.5 mil to this day. So 200K equivalent to nowadays is 1.5 mil. That's a huge jump.
That was like 50 years ago. It's like, where did we go with our economy?
Let's not get into that. That's a whole nother podcast on its own. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, that's just crazy. I actually, while I was doing the research for this, which, by the way, guys, don't come at me, but I got most of my information from Wiki. I know it's not exactly the best source.
For those of you who can't see, I am rolling my eyes.
Hey, sometimes Wiki gives you some really good stuff.
Yeah, it gives you very good should it be credible stuff?
Actually, all the stuff on Wiki now is getting, has to be cited and put at the bottom of the page now.
That I did not know. That's interesting.
Yeah, so Wiki is starting to be, back in the day, Wiki used to be just random facts and no, you didn't have to cite your work.
People with false information posting stuff because they think they know the truth or they want to troll people.
Right. So now Wiki has started to become a, wanting to become a reliable source. So they're actually asking people to put their, to cite their work. So if you look really careful, if you look on Wiki at the end of most, a lot of sentences are usually APA format of where they cited and then the link is on the bottom. So what I did is I clicked those links, read those articles that it originally came for, came from, and was just like, okay, yeah, this is credible then. So I didn't exactly just like, but most of my source, I will admit, came from Wiki. So those who don't like Wiki, I'm sorry, but I double checked a lot of the stuff that I did with other websites and they worked together. So
you fact checked everything.
I did. I fact checked at least 90% of this stuff. So
anyway, about 10 of it could be made up.
I mean, it could, but I mean, I have my own theories and hypotheses that I throw in here. So again, we will get into it. He sent in the ransom, which is equivalent to 1.5 mil today, and the request for 4 parachutes upon landing in Seattle. But let's take a
Four parachutes?
4 parachutes.
I thought it was just D.B. Cooper that was... hostage situation.
We'll get into why he requested 4 parachutes. So...
Oh, never mind. I remember now.
So, let's take a step back. The hijacker had identified himself as Dan Cooper in order to buy his one-way ticket to Portland, Oregon, but reporters confused his name with an actual suspect, and the hijacker subsequently... became known as D.B. Cooper. On Thanksgiving Eve, November 24th, 1971, a man carrying a black... I can't even say this. It's a French fucking word. But basically, a black...
Let me see. Attaché.
Attaché. That's
You've like, never heard of that before?
Not really. And I like... Okay, let me start over again.
Okay.
On Thanksgiving Eve, November 24th, 1971, a man carrying a black attaché case... approached the flight counter of Northwest Orient Airline at Portland International Airport. Using cash, the man bought a one-way ticket on flight 305, a 30-minute trip north to SeaTac, also known as Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. On the ticket, the man listed his name as D.B. Cooper. Again, back in the day, you actually didn't need... like, you could just give them a name. And they were like, okay, we're going to compare it to, like, a legal document. Like usually you use a driver's license or passport. No, back in the day, you just...
some type of self-identification.
Yeah, no, back in those days, you just literally told them, this is my name, and that's what they had to go by. And that's how it happened. So, again, on the ticket, the man listed his name as Dan Cooper. Eyewitness described Cooper as a white male in his mid-40s with a dark hair... and brown eyes, wearing a black or brown business suit, a white shirt, a thin black tie, a black raincoat, and brown shoes, carrying a briefcase and brown paper bag. Cooper boarded flight 305, a Boeing 707-100. Cooper took seat 18E in the last row and ordered a drink, a bourbon and 7-Up from the flight attendant.
Classy.
Yes. Shortly after takeoff, D.B. Cooper handed the note to the flight attendant and instructed her to open the note. Skaffner opened the note.
The name, right?
Yes. It's S-C-H-A-F-F-N-E-R. Skaffner, right?
Skaffner. I mean, I'm not very good with names either.
I'm horrible with names. You guys should know that by now. So Skaffner opened the note in neat, all capital letters printed with a felt pen tip. A felt tip pen, Cooper had written, "Miss, I have a bomb in my briefcase and want you to sit by me." Skaffner returned the note to Cooper. She sat down as he requested and quietly asked to see the bomb. He opened his briefcase and she saw 2 rows of 4 red cylinders, which she assumed were dynamite. Attached to the cylinders was a wire and a large cylindrical battery, which appeared to resemble a bomb. Cooper closed the briefcase and told Skaffner his demands. She wrote a note with Cooper's demands and brought it to the cockpit and informed the flight crew of the situation. Captain Scott directed her to remain in the cockpit for the remainder of the flight and took notes of events as they happened. He then contacted Northwest Flight Operations in Minnesota and relayed the hijacker's demand. Quote, Cooper requests $200,000 in a knapsack by 5 p.m. He wants two front parachutes, two back parachutes. He wants the money in negotiable American currency. By requesting two sets of parachutes, Cooper implied that he planned to take a hostage with him. Cooper was open to the fact that authorities might supply him with non-functional equipment. With Schaffner in the cockpit, flight attendant Merklo sat next to Cooper to act as a liaison between him and the flight crew in the cockpit. He then made additional demands. Upon landing in Seattle, the fuel trucks must meet the plane and all passengers must remain seated while she brought the money aboard. He said he would release the passenger after he had the money and the listed items brought aboard would be the four parachutes. Captain Scott informed Seattle-Tacoma Airport Air Traffic Control of the situation, who contacted local police and the FBI. The passengers were told their arrival in Seattle would be delayed because of a minor mechanical difficulty. Donald Nope, the president of Northwest Orient, authorized payment of the ransom and ordered all employees to cooperate with the hijacker and comply with his demands. For approximately 2 hours, what is originally a 45 to an hour long flight, flight 305 gave Seattle police and the FBI significant time to assemble Cooper's ransom money and parachute and to mobilize emergency personnel. During the flight from Portland to Seattle, Cooper demanded that Merklo remain by his side at all times. She later said that he appeared familiar with the local terrain. While looking out of the window, he remarked, quote, "Looks like Tacoma down there," as the aircraft flew above it. He also recently noted that McChord Air Force Base was only 20 minutes drive from the SeaTac airport. Merklo later described Cooper's demeanor. Quote, "Cooper was not nervous. He seemed rather nice and he was not cruel or nasty," end quote.
So going back to that 45 minute thing, the flight's supposed to be 45 minute, then being told that it's going to be like an additional 2 hours. Time.
Yeah.
You could almost see the amount of people being like, "Oh, okay, I can do that." But like nowadays, it'd be like an extra 1 hour and 15 minutes. What the fuck? It's just,
dude, going on planes nowadays, people are just so fucking impatient. People are just a-holes, to be honest. They like, I don't know if they seem privileged or they seem whatever, but I don't like dealing with people on airplanes. I'm one of those people who will be one of the last people to board. Go straight to the very back of the plane and sit as far back and away from people as possible.
Assuming there's no assigned seating.
If there's no assigned seating. But, and the one thing that, you want to know something that grinds my gears?
Jeez.
Something that really bothers me is when the plane lands and then everyone just fucking stands up and is just rushing and waiting to get to the front of the plane. Like, you are at the end of the fucking plane. At the end. You are obviously not going to go anytime soon. Sit the fuck down. Be calm and relax until it's your turn to go.
Yeah.
There are people who will literally try to grab their stuff and rush ahead in the way back to try and beat everyone else.
What is your rush?
I don't know. Again, planes irk me. I don't use them often, but when I do, they tend to irk me. So, anyways, rant over. While the plane circled Seattle, Merklo chatted with Cooper and asked why he picked Northwest Airline to hijack. He laughed and replied, "It's not because I have a grudge against your airline. It's just because I have a grudge." He then explained that his flight simply suited his needs. He asked where she was from. She answered that she was originally from Pennsylvania, but was living in Minneapolis at the time. Say that 10 times fast. Minneapolis
at the time.
Yeah. Cooper responded that Minneapolis was a very nice place. She asked where he was from, but he became upset and refused to answer. He asked if she could smoke and offered her a cigarette. She replied that she had quit, but accepted the cigarette anyways. They basically made small talk.
Under that pressure, it's just like, you know what, give me all of them.
Right. But then, back in the day, this was okay to smoke in the airplane. Which I don't know. I hate the smell of cigarettes. And if I was stuck in a plane with people just constantly smoking cigarettes,
it was a different time. It was
back in the day. Everyone fucking smoked. Yeah, like
everybody smoked because nobody really knew the health risks that it has today. Right. Not only that, but they're just like, well, I'm the one smoking. How is it going to affect the people around me?
Right. And I could just imagine how it would smell and walking. It's like walking into an ashtray. It's probably gross. Or just
getting into a car where you can tell somebody's been smoking.
And... Dude, I had a rental car once where it literally said no smoking. And I got in there and it smelled like someone had been smoking in there. Yeah, I even to the point where I was like, maybe I should go back and let them know how it smells. Because when I return it, they're going to think it was me.
It was you.
And I was just like, no, I'm going to leave it as be. So yeah, anyways, they basically made small talk the whole time. But when asked any questions about himself, he really didn't answer much. The FBI record note, Cooper briefly spoke to an unidentified passenger while the plane maintained its holding pattern over Seattle. In his interview with the FBI agent, passenger George, this last name, people's last names, why can't they just be easy?
Why don't you just say the first initial of his last name?
George L. Yes, I'm not even going to attempt his last name. I'm sorry. It's that bad. George L. said he visited the restroom directly behind Cooper several occasions. After one visit, George said the path to his seat was blocked by a passenger wearing a cowboy hat, questioning Merklow about this supposed mechanical issue delaying them to land.
Was it the Duke?
I don't fucking know. George said Cooper was...
Could you imagine him being on there, though? A freaking, what's his...
Big Jake?
The guy who played... John Wayne.
Oh, yeah, Big Jake.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's the guy in the cowboy hat.
Oh. You can call him a daddy, you can call me a dirty son of a bitch, but if you ever call me...
Daddy again.
Yeah, if you ever call me daddy again, I will finish this fight. Yes. Anyway, yeah, maybe that was him. But anyways, George said Cooper was initially amused by the interaction, but then became irate and told the man to return to his seat. But the cowboy ignored Cooper and continued to question her. George claimed he eventually persuaded the cowboy to return to his seat. So,
Who persuaded him to go
George,
back?
George. The guy with the last name I can't pronounce.
L.
Yeah, George L.
Just call him L.
Yeah, so he was basically telling the Duke to calm the fuck down.
Not L from Death Note, but no. Yeah, just George L. Just call him GL.
Merklow's version of the interaction differed from George's. She said the passenger approached her and asked for a sports magazine to read because he was bored. She and the passenger moved to an area directly behind Cooper and started to look for magazines. The passenger took a copy of the New Yorker and returned to his seat. When Merklow returned to sit with Cooper, he said, "If that is the Sky Marshal, I don't want any more of that." Despite his brief interaction with Cooper, the cowboy was not interviewed by FBI and was never actually identified.
Cowboy, quotation marks.
Yeah, that's what they always refer to him to because...
They don't know his name or anything.
They didn't know his name or anything about him.
He's just some random dude and he's like, hey, I need to ask these questions. And
yeah, and apparently Cooper for a moment thought that was the Sky Marshal and told him, I don't want him out of his seat anymore. And
just toss him out of the plane.
Right. Here's a parachute for you. So the 200,000 ransom.
Maybe the cowboy was in on it.
I mean, there are rumors and that went around saying that he had an accomplice. But then there's some that said that he worked alone. But we'll get into that.
Yes.
So the 200,000 ransom was received from Seattle's First National Bank in a bag weighing approximately 19 pounds. The money was 10,000 unmarked $20 bills, most of which had serial numbers beginning with the letter L. It was photographed on microfilm by the FBI. Seattle police obtained the two front parachutes from a local skydiving school and the two back parachutes from a local stunt pilot. All right. Around 5:24 p.m., Captain Scott was informed that the parachutes had been delivered to the airport and notified Cooper that they would be landing soon. At 5:46 p.m., Flight 305 landed at Seattle-Tacoma Airport. With Cooper's permission, Scott parked the aircraft on a partially lit runway away from the main terminal. Cooper demanded that only one representative of the airline approach the plane with the parachutes and money, and the only entrance and exit would be through the aircraft's front door via the mobile air stairway. So this thing that comes down.
Yeah.
Northwest Orient Seattle Operations Manager A. Lee, A. Lee, was designated to be the carrier. To avoid the possibility that Cooper might mistaken Lee's airline uniform for that of a law enforcement officer, he changed into civilian clothes for the task. With the passengers remaining seated, a group crew attached the mobile staircase. Per Cooper's demands, Merklo exited the aircraft through the front door, retrieved the ransom money. She returned and carried the money bag past the seated passengers to Cooper in the last row. Cooper then agreed to release the passengers. As they debarked, Cooper inspected the money. In an attempt to break the tension, Merklo jokingly asked Cooper if she could have some of the money. Cooper readily agreed and handed her a pack of money, but she immediately returned the money and explained accepting gratuity was against the company's policy.
Bullshit. You know, wholeheartedly, she would have been like,
right.
Dobiakin has sock, kind of. It's just, yeah, you're saying that jokingly, but how jokingly were you saying that? Or just like, right. on the record, I said that in quotations jokingly. Right. It's just like, I gave him back the money.
Deep down inside, she probably like put that, she like, I hid this.
Yeah. What she didn't say was that he gave her two stacks of money and she gave him back one.
So, yeah. She said Cooper had tried to tip her and the other two flight attendants earlier in the flight with money from his own pocket, but they had each declined, citing the policy. So he was like, here's the money.
It's like, I'm rich, bitch. Here, take it.
With the passengers gone, only Cooper and the six crew members remained on board. In accordance with Cooper's demand, Merklo made three trips outside of the aircraft to retrieve the parachutes, which she brought to him in the rear of the plane. While Merklo brought aboard the parachutes, Schaffner asked Cooper if she could retrieve her purse, stored in the compartment behind the seat. Cooper agreed and told her, I won't bite you. Flight attendants Hancock and
Schaffner... I would sure hope not.
Well, this is showing again how calm he was the entire time.
I won't fight you, right, or I won't bite you.
I won't bite you. Like, he's saying how calm he is. Like, he's holding this plane.
Oh, okay. So he's saying it metaphorically.
Joking.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's joking with these guys.
Like,
so
I don't bite. And then she's like, well, why not? She's kind of.
Yeah. So they're basically showing.
Or do you think she'd be like, I'm sorry, I can't accept tips?
But basically, she's showing the entire time how calm he was.
Yeah.
And how he was joking the entire time.
For sure, he was definitely getting right out of this without
exactly
getting
caught. Like, he had this plan down to a T. So, flight attendant Hancock and Schaffner debarked. When Merklo bought the final parachute to Cooper, she gave him printed instructions for using the parachute. But Cooper said he didn't need them. A problem with the refueling process caused the delay. It took three trucks to complete the refueling. During the delay, Merklo and Cooper complained the money was delivered in a cloth bag instead of a knapsack as he directed, and he now had to improvise a new way to transport the money. Using a pocket knife, again, something you could have brought on back in the day, but not now, Cooper cut the canopy from one of the reserve parachutes and stuffed some money in the empty parachute bag instead. An FAA official required a face-to-face meeting with Cooper aboard the aircraft, but Cooper denied their request. Cooper became impatient, saying, this shouldn't take so long, and let's get the show on the road. He then gave the cockpit crew his flight plan and devised directives. A southeast course toward in Mexico City, at the minimum airspeed possible, without stalling the aircraft, approximately 100 knots, which is 115 miles per hour, at a maximum 1,000 foot altitude.
That's low.
Very low. Cooper also specified the landing gear must remain deployed. The wing flaps must be lowered to 15 degrees and the cabin must remain unpressurized.
So he knows his way around an airplane.
He obviously does. Right. So all these demands, this is definitely not someone who's just...
So he's kind of like somebody who's trying to get back at the man, and he's just like, I want money from government. And you're just... It kind of seems like this guy might be like ex-Air Force military and he kind of knows.
Right. So we're going to get into stuff like that. So all the people that they were looking at, who they thought were D.B. Cooper, there were certain criteria that they were looking for. And we'll see when we go through suspects.
Okay.
So first officer Rakitshkov informed Cooper that the configuration limited the aircraft's range to about 1,000 miles, so the second refueling would be necessary before entering Mexico. Cooper and the crew discussed options and agreed on Reno Tahoe International Airport as the refueling stop. Cooper's further directed the aircraft take off with the rear exit door open and the air stairs extended. Northwest Home Office objected that this was unsafe. Cooper continued saying, quote, "It can be done, so do it," but did not argue the point and said he would lower the staircase once they were airborne. He demanded Merkler remain aboard to assist in the operation.
Wait, I feel like that's backwards. You mean he was going to bring it down or bring it up?
At first, they told him that they couldn't lower it or have it down while taking off.
Mm-hmm.
So he said when they get up to the appropriate air, he would lower the aircraft.
Oh, okay. So that way then, yeah, okay. Yeah. Never mind. The extra drag, it won't tear the thing off.
So, right,
okay.
Exactly. So back in the air, so around 7:40 p.m., Flight 305 took off with only Cooper, Merklo, Captain Scott, First Officer Kirkish, and flight engineer Anderson aboard. Two 5-106 fighters from the McChord Air Force Base and a Lockheed T-33 trainer followed the 727. All three jets stayed behind the slow-moving 727 and out of Cooper's view.
So these jets, are these ones like military jets?
Military jets, okay. Yes. Military jets were following. After takeoff, Cooper told Merklo to lower the AFT staircase. She told him and the flight crew that she feared being sucked out of the aircraft. The flight crew suggested she come to the cockpit and retrieve an emergency rope with which she could tie herself to a seat. Cooper rejected the suggestion and stated that he did not want her going up front or the flight crew coming back to the cabin. She continued to express her fear to him, and he asked him to cut some cord from one of the parachutes to create a safety line for her. He said he would lower the stairs himself, instructed her to go to the cockpit, close the curtain partition between coach and first class section, and not return.
You also have to think, too, like, cabin pressure back then wasn't the same as it is now, right?
No, definitely a huge difference.
Yeah,
like,
because I feel like there was even a difference from when I would take flights in the 90s to like...
Well, yeah, recently. I mean, technology changed a lot of stuff.
I know technology itself had taken a really big jump between the 90s till now. And that's just a span of, like, even 10 years ago, that technology has kind of expanded pretty vastly, so... Back in the 70s, it wouldn't be as much, right? Like
I'm not a plane person, so I don't know. I can't answer that for you.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, I'm not a plane person, so I can't answer that. So, told her to not return. Before she left, Merklo begged Cooper, please, please take the bomb with you. Cooper responded that he would either disarm it or take it with him. As she walked to the cockpit and turned to close the curtain, she saw Cooper standing in the aisle tying what appeared to be the money bag around his waist. From takeoff to when Merklo entered the cockpit, 4 to 5 minutes had elapsed. For the rest of the flight to Reno, Merklo remained in the cockpit and was the last person to see Cooper. Around 8 p.m., a cockpit warning light flashed, indicating that the staircase had been deployed. The pilots used the cabin intercom to ask Cooper if he needed assistance, but Cooper's last message was a one-worded reply. No.
Why?
No, no.
No. Nope. Just chill.
Yep. The crew's ears popped from the drop in cabin pressure from the stairs being opened. At approximately 8:13 p.m., the aircraft's tail section suddenly pitched upward, forcing the pilot to trim and return the aircraft to level flight. In his interview with the FBI, co-pilot Bill, that's why I'm just going to refer to him because I can't say his last
Bill,
name.
Bill.
Said the sudden upward pitch occurred when the flight was near the suburbs north of Portland. When the cabin door opened,
so and they haven't even reached Nevada yet then.
Nope.
Jeez, okay.
When the cabin door opened and the staircase deployed, the flight crew remained in the cockpit, unsure if Cooper was still aboard. Merkler used the cabin intercom to inform Cooper that they were approaching Reno, and he needed to raise the stairs so the plane could land safely. She repeated her request as the pilot made the final approach to land, but neither Merkler nor the flight crew received a reply from Cooper. At 11.02 p.m., with the staircase still deployed, Flight 305 landed at Reno Tahoe International Airport. FBI agents, state troopers, sheriff's deputy, and Reno police established a perimeter around the aircraft, but fearing that Cooper and the bomb were still aboard, did not approach the plane. Captain Scott searched the cabin, confirmed Cooper was no longer aboard, and after 30 minutes search, the FBI bomb squad declared the cabin free and safe.
Yeah, so
they don't know when he actually jumped.
Yeah, it's just he opened up the hatch. Did you need help? Nope. If anything,
bye, bitches.
That's probably where he jumped out of the plane.
More than likely, that's what they're guessing because it went quiet after that, and they're assuming that's what happened. So,
but the flight attendant, she had an eye on him, right?
No, like, she went into the cockpit. Oh. She saw him one last time, and he was standing there securing things onto him.
Well, then who was tied to the chair because they were afraid of getting sucked out?
That was Merklo. She was, but he told her she wanted to get a line from the cockpit and come back to tie herself into the seat. But he just told her, no, just go to the cockpit.
Stay in the cockpit.
Yeah, just stay in the cockpit. Don't come back out. So she even had asked him, can you cut a line from the parachute so I can tie myself to the seat just in case? And he told her, no, just go to the cockpit.
Yeah, I blinked on that spot because my brain is just like, coffee.
Well, drink donut. More coffee.
I know. No, it's just.
Have more of your donut.
I ate my donut. Oh, you it's ate all it? Gone already.
Oh, shit, I didn't even notice you.
I was a fatty with my donut. So you can't put a maple donut in front of me and expect me to not eat the whole thing in one sitting. Very rarely do I save the other half for later.
How's your drink?
It's actually pretty good. I'm drinking the coconut one.
Yeah. Okay. So, in addition to 66 latent fingerprints aboard the airline, FBI agents recovered Cooper's black clip-on tie, his tie clip, and two of the four parachutes, one of which had been open and had three shroud lines cut from the canopy. FBI agents interviewed eyewitnesses in Portland, Seattle, and Reno and developed a series of composite sketches. Local police and FBI agents immediately began questioning possible suspects. Acting on the possibility Cooper may have used his real name or some alias in a previous crime, Portland police discovered and interviewed a Portland civilian named D.B. Cooper. The Portland Cooper had a minor police record but was quickly eliminated as a suspect. And in his rush to meet a deadline, reporter James Long confused the man with the name used, and he ended up using it in the papers. So, hence the name D.B. Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
So, this guy just jumped the gun and was just like, he's it! And used his name, and that's how D.B. Cooper just stuck.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I heard about that one.
United Press International Wired Service reported Clyde Jabin republished Long's...
Jabin? He'd be Jabin?
Republished Long's error, and other media sources repeated the error, and his name just stuck as D.B. Cooper. Due to so many issues and variables, defining and pinpointing an area to search was difficult. The jet's airspeed estimated varied, and the environmental conditions along the flight points varied with the aircraft's location and altitude, and only Cooper knew how long he remained in the free fall before pulling his cord. The Air Force F-106 pilots neither saw anyone jump from the airline, nor did the radar detect a deployed parachute.
Well, he was still flying really low during this time too, right?
10,000 feet.
He couldn't really base jump it because...
I don't know anything about skydiving or jumping, so I'm not going to try and argue that. If my dad was here, he'd probably be able to help us because he was a parachuter when he was in the military.
Yeah.
So
maybe your dad's D.B. Cooper.
No, he is not.
No, I'm just kidding.
He jumped and no one caught a deployed on their radars. Nothing. It was impossible to see someone who was decked out in all black jumping in a moonless night. This would be beyond difficult, especially given the limited visibility, cloud coverage, and lack of ground landing. On December 6, 1971, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover approved the use of all Air Force SR-71 Blackbird to retrace and photograph Flight 305 flight path and attempt to locate the items Cooper carried during his jump. The SR-71 made 5 flights to retrace the aircraft route, but due to poor visibility, the photographs attempted were unsuccessful. In an experimental recreation, flying the same aircraft used in the hijacking in the same flight configurations, FBI agents pushed a 200-pound sled out of the open air stairs and were able to reproduce the upward motion, the tail section, and brief change in the cabin pressure described by the flight crew at 8:13 p.m. Remember when they lifted a bit?
Mm-hmm.
So initially, that's where they thought he jumped. So that was the time that they thought he jumped at, is when they felt that pressure change. So initially, they placed Cooper's landing zone within an area on the southmost outreach of Mount St. Helens, a few miles southeast of Ariel, Washington, near Lake Merwin, an artificial lake formed by a dam on the Lewis River. Search efforts focused on Clark and Cowichs County, encompassing the terrain immediately south and north of the Lewis River in southwest Washington. FBI agents and sheriff deputies searched the large area of the heavily wooded terrain on foot and by helicopter. Door-to-door searches of local farmhouses were carried out. Other search parties ran patrol boats along Lake Merwin and Yell Lake. The reservoir immediately to the east. Neither Cooper nor any of the equipment he presumably carried were found. Using fixed wiring aircraft and helicopters, the FBI coordinated an aerial search along the entire flight path from Seattle to Reno. Although numerous broken treetops and several pieces of plastic and other objects resembling parachute canopies were sighted and investigated, nothing relevant to the hijacking was ever found. Shortly after the spring thawed in early 1972, teams of FBI agents sighted by 200 soldiers along the United States Air Force personnel, National Guardsmen, and civilian volunteers, conducted another thorough ground search of Clark and Cowichs County for 18 days in March, and then another 18 days in April. Electronic Exploration Company, a marine salvaging firm, used a submarine to search the 200-foot depth of Lake Merwin. Two local women stumbled upon a skeleton in an abandoned structure in Clark County. It was later identified as the remains of Barbara Ann Derry, a teenage girl who had been abducted and murdered several weeks before.
Well, hey, something good came out of this heist.
And they found
somebody's missing body.
Yeah,
I don't mean to joke about it, but still. I mean,
at least they found her instead of her being mysteriously gone.
Yeah, at least the family has closure on that.
Right, and I'll cover that in another episode. Ultimately, this excessive search and recovery operation uncovered no significant material evidence relating to the hijacking. Based on early computer projections produced for the FBI, Cooper's drop zone was first estimated to be between Ariel Dam to the north and the town of Battleground, Washington to the south. In March 1972, after a joint investigation with Northwest Orient Airlines and the Air Force, the FBI determined Cooper probably jumped over the town of La Center, Washington. In 2019, the FBI released a report detailing the burglary of a grocery store about 3 hours after Cooper's jump near Heason, Washington. Heason, an unincorporated community, was within the calculated drop zone Northwest Airline predicted to the FBI. In the report, the FBI noted the burglar took only several items such as beef jerky and gloves.
Oh, so kind of your go-to.
Beef jerky. I love beef jerky. I need whenever I go on a road trip, what is the number one snack I have to have?
Beef jerky.
Beef fucking jerky.
Which is why I'm saying, oh, it's a Sam snack.
So Sam was there.
Maybe Sam's DB Cooper.
Yeah, I'm not even...
It's like, where's that money, Sam?
If I knew where that $1.5 million was at, we wouldn't be living in this small shack. Again, yeah, the person who didn't, anyways. All right, A month after the hijacking, the FBI distributed lists of the ransom serial numbers to the financial institutes, casinos, racetracks, and other businesses that routinely conducted large money transactions, and to law enforcement agencies around the world. Northwest Oriented offered a reward of 15% of the recovered money to a maximum of $25,000. In early 1972, a U.S. Attorney General J. M. Mitchell released the serial numbers to the general public. Two men used counterfeit $20 bills printed with Cooper's serial numbers to swindle $30,000 from Newsweek reporter named Carrie Fleming in exchange for an interview with a man they falsely claimed was the hijacker.
Wow.
In early 1973, with the ransom money still missing, an Oregon journal republished the serial numbers and offered $1,000 to the first person to turn in a ransom bill to the newspaper or any FBI field agent. In Seattle, a post-intelligencer made a similar offer with a $5,000 reward. The offer remained in effect until Thanksgiving 1974, and though several near matches were reported, no genuine bills were found. In 1975, Northwest Orient Global Company complied with an order from the Minnesota Supreme Court and paid the airline $180,000, equivalent to $978,000 in 2022, claim of the ransom money. So they paid him back. All right. Well,
there's that at least.
At least they got some of their money back. Later, analysts indicated that the original landing zone estimated was inaccurate. Captain Scott, who was flying the aircraft manually because of Cooper's speed and altitude demands, later determined that his flight path was further east than initially thought. Additional data from various of sources, in particular Continental Airline pilot Tom Bohim, who was flying 4 minutes behind flight 305, indicated the wing direction factored into drop zone calculations had been wrong, possibly by as much as 80 degrees. This and other supplemental data suggested that the actual drop zone was south-southeast of the original estimate, and the drainage area of Washougal River. Washougal River. In 1986, FBI agent Ralph... You're going to hear this name a lot, by the way.
Ralph?
Ralph Himmelbacher wrote, "I have to confess, if I were going to look for Cooper, I would head for Washougal, the lake or the river. The Washougal Valley is surrounding having been searched repeatedly in subsequent years. To date, no discoveries traceable to the hijacking have been reported. Some investigators have speculated that in the 1980 eruptions of Mount St. Helens could have obliterated any remaining physical evidence."
Fantastic.
Obliter.
Do you think he predicted that too? It's just like, if I want any of this evidence to be destroyed, then this volcano should erupt, right?
I mean, Mount St. Helens is supposed to erupt any minute now, from what, knock on fucking wood, but people have been saying that Mount St. Helens is going to erupt again soon, but... Like, we're all waiting for that giant earthquake to happen as well.
Let's not put that out there in the water because, I have to go to San Francisco to work.
Yeah, I know. And we all know my irrational fears of earthquakes. So let's not get into that because we got into that before.
Yeah.
On July 8th, 2016, the FBI announced active investigation of Cooper's case was suspended, citing the need to focus investigative resources and manpower on issues of higher and more urgent priority.
You think? Why hasn't this turned into a cold case yet?
It is a cold case now.
I know it's a cold case now, but why wait until 2016
Right? That was how many years later?
It's just like, this dude stole this amount of money, but if you're looking at all the evidence and there doesn't seem to be any leads to where this guy could be, why continue to keep the case open until...
Nothing.
Right. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover isn't even lead of the FBI anymore. Why even...
I'm going to actually get into why the investigation stayed long because I have hypotheses and
You have a thesis?
I have a thesis. I have an idea of what it could be about. So you're going to hear my wacky.
Part of me thinks like the whole flight crew was in on it and was like, oh, we'll say that we dropped you possibly landed over there and instead like give them false information on where you actually jumped out from. So, yeah, I don't know. Just why jokingly say, oh, can I get a cut of that money? And then say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't accept any tips or anything like that. So it's just like, come on.
It's all a conspiracy.
Yeah, it's all. Jeez,
we're going to get into that. Yep.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay, let's get on.
All right. Local field office would continue to accept any legitimate physical evidence related specifically to the parachute or to the ransom money. That may emerge in the future. A 66-volume case file compiled over the 45-year course of the investigation would be preserved for historical purposes at the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. and on the FBI website. All the evidence is open to public. The crime remains the only unsolved case in air piracy in commercial aviation history. Yeah, you can actually view the documents.
The there. Documents and all the people were given their two cents on what could have possibly happened.
It's not a whole lot, actually. They only have like maybe 50 pages.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's not that big because I'm going to get into it.
You know what my theory is?
Aliens.
Yes. I'm just kidding. D.B. Cooper was actually a lizard person.
Oh my God.
And everybody on the flight were lizard people or going to be indoctrinated to being lizard people. And the reason why the case stayed open so long is because the men in black were trying to find
him. Oh my God.
That's my theory. It's just
let's drop that. Okay. Yeah. So there's a reason why the files were so short and we'll get into that. So during the forensic search of the aircraft, FBI agents found four major pieces of evidence, which with direct physical link to Cooper, a black clip-on tie, a mother of the pearl tie clip, a hair from the Cooper's headrest, and 8 filter tips cigarette butts from the armrest ashtray. So let's take a small look into the evidence that was left behind. First, let's talk about the clip-on necktie. FBI agents found a black clip-on necktie in seat 18E where Cooper had been seated. Attached to the tie was a gold tie clip with a circular mother of the pearl setting in the center of the clip. The FBI determined the tie had been sold exclusively at JCPenney's department stores and had been discontinued in 1968. By late 2005, the FBI had built a partial DNA profile from samples found on Cooper's tie in 2001. However, the FBI also acknowledged no evidence linked Cooper to the source of the DNA sample. Said FBI Special Agent Fred Gutt, the tie had 2 small DNA samples and 1 large sample. It's difficult to draw a firm conclusion from these samples. The FBI also made public a file of previously unreleased evidence, including Cooper's plane ticket, composite sketch, fact sheets, and posted a request for information about Cooper's identification. In March 2009, a group of civilian sleuths took a whack at it. They used modern technology and found a lot of stuff. They analyzed materials found on the tie and narrowed down that Cooper likely worked with an airline company in building the plane or something of that field.
Where's the credibility in that? These are the wiki people of sleuthing. It's just like, let's just, in quotations, find this evidence that apparently has never been found before.
Right, and that the FBI haven't found. There was a lot of detail about scientific terms, but I don't want to get into it because they got into like the nitty gritty of like this dirt was found on it and only this dirt is found in this location. So it was just so much information that I'm like, I'm not going to put that in there. So there was a lot of information. Again, it's crazy. Ton of people try to figure this out themselves, but so far not very successful, obviously. Now let's talk about the hair sample they found on the headrest of the seat. FBI agents found 2 hair samples in Cooper's seat, a single strand of limp hair on the seat and a single strand of brown Caucasian head hair on the headrest.
I thought you were going to say an erect piece of hair.
No. The limp hair was destroyed after the FBI crime laboratory determined the sample lacked enough unique microscopic characteristics to be useful. This just blew my mind. I'm like, they could have held on to that until nowadays technology where they could have gotten more information, but instead they destroyed it. But I'm going to get into why they did that. However, the FBI crime laboratory determined that the head hair was suitable for future comparisons and preserved the hair on a microscopic slide. During this attempt to build Cooper's DNA profile in 2002, the FBI discovered the hair sample had been lost.
Of course it did.
Right. Again, we're going to get into that. I jumped onto that conspiracy. Anyways, so not much came from the hair, but I bet if they tested it now with nowadays technology, something could have been found, but we'll never know. But this leads me to the cigarette butts that were found. In the armrest tray, the ashtray on C-18E, FBI agents found 8 filter-tipped cigarette butts. These were sent to the FBI crime lab to search for fingerprints, but investigators were unable to find fingerprints and returned the buds to the Las Vegas field office. In 1998, the FBI sought to extract DNA from the cigarette butts, but discovered the butts had been destroyed while in the custody of Las Vegas field office. Again,
well, I know what probably happened. They probably had a tray of those cigarettes from the plane, and somebody was smoking and started putting their cigarettes into that tray.
Now, I have a theory. Again, another thing that destroyed that could have shed some light. A little bit of hope came when some of the ransom money was recovered on February 10th, 1980. 8-year-old Bran Ingram was vacationing with his family on the Columbian River. As he ranked the sand riverbank to build a campfire, he uncovered 3 packs of ransom cash, totaling around $5,800. The bills had disintegrated from length exposure to the elements, but were still bound in rubber bands. FBI technicians confirmed the money was indeed a portion of the ransom, 2 packs of $120 bills each, all arranged in the same order as when given to Cooper. This launched several new grounds of investigation. They later determined the bills had not been buried, but may have been washed up and were not there by human means, but by natural means. After carefully looking at the bills, it really didn't help them to get closer to finding Cooper. What good came from this in 1986, after negotiation, the recovered bills were divided equally between Brian Ingram and the Northwest Orient insurer Royal Global Insurance. The FBI retained 14 examples as evidence. Ingram sold 15 of his bills at auction in 2008 for about $37,000, which is
piece or all together?
I think all together.
Okay, I was about to say.
That's equivalent to $50,000, though.
Yeah.
So
still,
yeah. It's just, So the Columbian River ransom money remains the only confirmed physical evidence from the hijacking found outside of the aircraft. Lastly, let's talk about the parachutes. During the hijacking, Cooper demanded and received 2 main chutes and 2 reserve chutes. The 2 reserve chutes were supplied by a local skydiving school, and the 2 main chutes were supplied by a local pilot. Normal Hayden, Earl Kalsey, the parachute rigger who packed all 4 parachutes bought to Cooper, described the 2 main chutes as emergency bailout parachutes. Kalsey further described the main chute as being like military chutes because they were rigged to open immediately upon the ripcord being pulled and was incapable of being steered. When the plane landed in Reno, FBI agents discovered 2 parachutes that Cooper left behind, 1 reserve chute and 1 main chute. The reserve chute had been opened and 3 shroud lines had been cut out, and the main chute left behind was still intact. The unused main chutes were described by FBI agents as a mobile MB-6 and is on display at the Washington State Historical Society Museum. One of the 2 reserve chutes Cooper was given was unusable training chutes intended to only be used for classroom demonstration. According to Kalsey, the reserve chutes internal canopy was sewn together so skydiving students could get the feel of pulling a ripcord on a packed parachute without the canopy actually deploying. So, this non-functional reserve parachute...
Could you imagine if a tire just came out of it?
This isn't freaking Roger Rabbit. Here you go. Here's your
chute. Just for show.
Here's your spare. So the non-functional reserve parachutes were not found in the aircraft when landed in Reno, leading FBI agents to speculate Cooper was not an expert parachuter because someone with experience would have realized the reserve chutes were dummy chutes. You think there's more evidence? Really, there isn't, actually. That's all they had. There wasn't a whole lot to go off of, and
sure the dummy shoots are like a red herring, and this is just like, make it look like he wasn't experienced when he knows all this aviation stuff.
Right, so, but that's something we want to get into. There wasn't a whole lot to go off of, and one reason why it's because Cooper didn't leave much behind. Hence why this case is still unsolved to this day. I'm sure you want to get into some theories and possible suspect, but that's going to have to wait until next week.
What?
Dun, dun, dun. Unless we want this to be a super, super long episode. We'll wait until next week. Well, for you guys, you won't hear this for two more weeks.
2 weeks, yeah.
So you're just going to have to.
Unless you want to release these two like side by side.
Hell no, they're going to be released every 2 weeks like my schedule.
Okay.
So.
There's a lot more details.
Well, we're going to. The next section is we're going to get into theories and
suspects
and what ifs, what could possibly, and what I think happened. Because I always have to give my 2 cents, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to give my 2 cents what I think happened, and we'll get into it next episode. So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and sorry I'm leaving it off on a cliffhanger, but I'm not sorry. Sorry, not sorry. Because I think it's worth it. At first, originally, this episode was only supposed to be one episode. But when I compiled all this stuff together, I was just, you know what? Let's make it a 2 episode.
Yeah.
Because, you know. And then, So instead of next week being a paranormal myth, the next one is going to be the continuation of D.B. Cooper. So stay tuned for the next part of D.B. Cooper. And again,
or we can just pull the South Park and just because it's April Fools.
When this comes out, it's not going to be April though.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So anyways, thank you guys for listening. If you guys want to, you can follow us on Instagram or Facebook. We are Tea Time Horror Stories or Tea Time Horrors. You can always email us at teatimehorrorstories@gmail.com. If you have any questions, requests, or if you want to correct me on something, because, you know, I'm not a genius and whatever I find is what I find online. If I am butchering someone's name so, so bad and you really want to correct me with how it's said pronounced, please, I'm okay with that as well. You can DM me on social media. Again, we only have Instagram and Facebook. Please rate and review us too. That would be great because that way more people can see us. If you guys have any special requests, give us a ringer.
Holla.
And we will try and fit that into our schedule. Otherwise, stay spooky, my friends.
Happy haunting.
Bye.